Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State University. Today, I'm welcoming back David Lester and Marcus Redeker to the New Books Network. They're here to speak about their latest book, Under the Banner of King Death, Pirates of the Atlantic, a graphic novel, published by Beacon Press in 2023. David Lester is an author and graphic artist. His work includes, but is not limited to, 1919, A Graphic History of the Winnipeg General Strike, Direct Action Gets the Goods, A Graphic History of the Strike in Canada, Drawn to Change, Graphic Histories of the Working Class Struggle, and The Listener, a graphic novel. He's also the guitarist for a duo in Vancouver, Mecca Normal. And I made the joke last time, and it still stands that he's a lot cooler than me. Marcus Redeker, a scholar of piracy and slavery, is a distinguished professor of Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh. He is the author of numerous books on the history of piracy, the slave trade in the Atlantic world, such as The Many-Headed Hydra, The Slave Ship, A Human History, Villains of All Nations, Outlaws of the Atlantic, The Amistad, and The Fearless Benjamin Lay, the Quaker dwarf who became the first revolutionary abolitionist. And he's turned the story of the mighty Benjamin Lay into a stage play recently. Last year, I had the pleasure of speaking with both David and Marcus about their book, Profit Against Slavery, Benjamin Lay, a graphic novel, also published by Beacon Press in 2021. Under the Banner of King Death, Pirates of the Atlantic, a graphic novel, I think that'll be the last time I give the full title, is a comic adaptation of Redeker's now classic 2004 Villains of All Nations, Atlantic Pirates in the Golden Age. Really one of the foundational texts in serious pirate studies. David Lester, Marcus Redeker, David and Marcus, if I may, welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you, Mike.
Good
to be back with you again.
Yeah. So, David, before we get into Under the Banner of King Death, please tell us a little bit about yourself. I asked you this question last time, but let me ask it again. How did you become a graphic historian?
Well, one has to go back to the childhood of oneself. And, you know, I grew up, I loved drawing and that I loved comics. And one of my favorites was Classics Illustrated, which told many stories of history. And my interest in drawing led me to go to the library and take out books on art history, where I discovered a thing called history paintings. And when I was a teenager, about 15, I did a monthly comic for a youth liberation publication out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, called FPS. And it was to take historical figures and quotes that they had on education, on youth growing up, on the dynamic of parents and children. And so there I was right away as a teen linking art, history, and in my view, politics. And from there, I took diverged into graphic design and music for a long time. And then I started a poster series called Inspired Agitators, which featured historical figures who were activists or radicals at a moment in time, they did something extraordinary. And from there, I created my first graphic novel called The Listener, which concerned the rise of the Nazi Party and Hitler during the Weimar years. And that led me to meet up with the Graphic History Collective, where I worked on, as you mentioned, several books on labor history, particularly 1919, A Graphic History of the Winnipeg General Strike. And that led me to working with Marcus and Paul. And Paul had been involved in, as we were talking off air, in so many projects that relate to history and graphic novels. And he was very much involved with the Graphic History Collective in guiding them and editorially working with them. And so it was that connection with him that led me to, again, working on these projects to currently the book that we're talking about today, Under the Banner of King Death.
Mm-hmm. And so much of your work focuses on the history of labor activism, and your collaborations with Marcus definitely are doing history in the vein of social justice. Do you see your graphic work as a contribution to various struggles?
Well, again, I have to look at it, you know, from a personal perspective and a personal history, that my grandfather was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, which was founded in America in the early part of the 20th century. It's was a revolutionary radical syndicalist union. And so if we fast forward 70 years to me and my brother living in grandpa's house, and he had died. And at the time, we had invited a speaker from the CNT in Spain, the Confederation of National Trade Unions, which is not unlike the Industrial Workers of the World, being kind of a syndicalist, kind of more veering towards an anarchist type of union. And they had just been legalized after the end of the dictatorship in the 70s in Spain. And we were part of a group that brought a member over to tell people what was going on in Spain at the time. And he stayed at my house, and so after the speech and the next morning, I got up and got my coffee and I walked into the living room, and there he was, sitting in Grandpa's lazy boy chair. And it was in that moment that I thought, okay, there's the thread of history from, you know, the guy who was in the Industrial Workers of the World, that's his chair, to the guy in the CNT, and their long history, and then it's up to, you know, virtually the present day. And then that leads me back to going 300 years to our book that we're discussing today. And I see the thread of it all to be with to do with workers' rights, workers' history, labor history, and people trying to make a better world. And so the thread there, you know, that is the importance of the linkage of all that. But I see that graphic novels are, to me, an important part of activist art, the future of activist art. And it's particularly important in education, as I see more and more teachers of history using graphic novels in that process. And that the role that they play is quite significant, because the students are the future voters, the future labor leaders, the future activists. And so the role of graphic novels is very important as a form. And then combine it with our depiction of what I would call, you know, social justice history or radical history. And so there's the role that graphic novels can play, and the role that we can play as makers of graphic novels.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I think there's always a little bit of a slightly subversive element to the graphic genre. I mean, maybe it's just the stuff I read, but you know, somewhat left of center. I mean, Doonesbury's, as a kid, I was a precocious kid reading Doonesbury, right? And like this is like at, I don't know, age probably 7 or 8, I learned about the American War in Vietnam and so forth. And then think about, you know, Mad Magazine as this cultural subversive act. And then I think it was Rius's Cuba for Beginners, that from the 70s or 80s, that like, as a precocious kid, you know, probably middle school or high schooler, got me to realize, oh, comics can have a serious can be the serious medium.
Well, you know, I grew up also reading underground comics, and so the subversiveness of them, some of them may not have been particularly political, but they certainly artistically were quite subversive. And of course, you mentioned Mad Magazine. I read that all the time. And there was a subversiveness to that, which you didn't find in other mass media. And so comics have played this role that I think even going back 300 years to people like Gilroy, who satirized the ruling classes, and even Hogarth at times. And so I think there's been a long tradition of that, including editorial cartoonists, which you don't see so much today. They're quite soft now, but the editorial cartoons in the newspapers used to be very biting. And I devoured those as well. And not to mention the great Ron Cobb, who did editorial cartoon in many of the underground newspapers in the 60s, 70s. You know, he's not alone in that process. So I feel comics are connected very much with radicalism and the subversive nature of combining words and text. I mean, words and art, I should say.
Right. And Marcus, could you tell us a bit about your career trajectory and how you came to be a scholar of pirate ships and the slave trade?
Well, Mike, my career trajectory early on was to become a basketball player in the NBA.
Is this breaking news? Is this breaking news? Do we get a New Books History scoop?
Yeah, this is a scoop. Actually, most anybody who knows me knows that I've loved the game for a long time and still do. But I played in high school, I played in college, and then I discovered that there was really a serious problem with this career plan, that I wasn't a good enough basketball player to play in the NBA. So here I am working in a factory. I dropped out of school in 1971. I'm working in a factory, taking night classes, and I meet a professor named Alan Briceland at Virginia Commonwealth University. I'm going to night classes. And he basically shows me that becoming a historian is an option. I grew up in a working class family. I didn't know it was an option, frankly, that one could make a life around being a historian. So to make a long story short, when I went off eventually to graduate school, I was going to become a historian of slavery in the Caribbean, especially, and in North America. But when I got to graduate school, I wrote a first seminar paper on pirates, and I was hooked. So at that point, I wrote a dissertation about sailors and pirates in the 18th century. And then as I moved through subsequent research projects, I came back around to the question of slavery. And eventually, what I wanted to do was to take some of this history from below. And I think that's how I would describe not only my work, but the work David and I are doing, graphic history from below. I wanted to reach new readers, and especially younger readers. So I teamed up with Paul Buell. He made the connection to David. And two graphic novels later, with a third in process, here we are. So that's how it happened.
Fantastic. So what was it like sort of being on the, you know, the pioneer of serious pirate studies? I know that there are popular histories,
right?
But, I mean, this isn't my area of historical expertise, but my understanding is like you're really the pioneer and really established this as a field. I mean, was there some pushback? I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, it's actually true that when I started working on sailors and pirates, what's now 40 odd years ago, neither one of them were subjects of serious scholarly work. In fact, labor historians didn't even consider sailors part of labor history because they didn't produce commodities. Labor history then was completely defined by male industrial workers. So this was kind of an interesting issue. So I had to fight for that. And the same was true of pirates. I mean, some people thought that this was kind of a silly subject, right? That it was a romantic thing. And there were some, you know, amateur historians who were very good.
Yeah.
There were some good amateur histories of piracy, but then some other people started working on it. And then some really good work was done. And now, on my desk behind me, I've got three new works of history coming out about piracy. Lots of people are working on it now. So there has been a very big change.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know that there's a recently published book posthumously by, David Graeber's.
David Graeber.
Pirate Enlightenment. I think I read your review of it. Right. And I mean, it's just, the field's in a level of sophistication now that that, you know, is quite admirable. So so Under the Banner of King Death is drawn from Villains of All Nations. Can you describe the process of what you wanted to pull, how you went about pulling out this graphic history, really graphic novel, from this longer, more conventional prose text?
Right. This is kind of a dilemma, because Villains of All Nations is a social portrait of an entire generation of pirates, and it's not a single storyline. But as it happens, or happened, I should say, in the past, I had been contacted years ago by an LA film producer, and he said, "Let's make a film, the first historically authentic film about pirates." He said, "Let's write a treatment." And I was so naive, I said, "Great, what's a treatment?" And so this is basically the storyline, right?
The story psychoanalysis, you're in treatment, right?
So I went back to Villains of All Nations and decided that I would try to translate this into a single narrative with a particular arc. And I had a lot of trouble writing it until I decided to create some characters and then put the story in motion and follow out what happened according to those historical characters as I had studied them and as I now imagined them. Well, to make a long story short, that film never got made, although Lionsgate did take an option on the book and put it through the process of development. We actually have a very good 2-hour screenplay about the book, but it just never happened.
So you didn't write Pirates of the Caribbean?
No, in fact, that was a very big problem for us, because Pirates of the Caribbean was quite popular at this time, and they drowned out practically everything else. But once that thing had run its course, we did find people who were receptive to a more historically accurate depiction of pirates. And by the way, I took my children to see Pirates of the Caribbean, and their attitude afterward was, never take a historian of piracy to see a pirate film, because all they do is complain about the inaccuracies and how silly it looked on the screen. But that was okay.
Yeah, I remember one scene from, I don't know, I'm one of the, like, 15 of those Johnny Depp films now, but I remember there's one scene where they're showing this colonial map of the world, and Africa is filled in with the rivers filled in. And I was in the theater yelling, "They didn't know where the Congo went. Like, this is right. This is an abomination."
Right. Yeah. So just to finish my answer to your question, Mike, when David and I decided that we wanted to produce a graphic novel, we went back to that treatment. And I worked on it some more. We adapted it. David and I worked on it. He translated it into a set of scenes. So we already had the storyline from a previous project, and that proved to be the basis of the new book.
So are the characters composite characters of individuals that you found in your historical research? You know, there's a character who's formerly enslaved. There's a character who's a woman who's passing as a male pirate and then reveals herself towards the end. Are these all drawn from individuals that you have studied?
Yes, they all have real analogs in the historical record. Mary or Mark Reed is based on a real person, a woman who dressed as a man and went to sea. That character is based on one specific person. The other two main characters, John Gwynn, a man who escaped from a plantation in South Carolina, became a pirate, and a Dutch sailor named Ruby Decker. They are kind of a composite of a bunch of different people that I had studied. So that's the way we created those characters.
And the story arc of the mutiny on the ship and the ship going breaking bad, going to piracy, and then attacking a slave fort on the west coast of Africa. This is drawn from historical record?
Yes it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, the way that you built that story is just so, so engaging. Got one other pirate question to ask you. What is the pirate's favorite letter?
I'm not going to say it, but
you can say it, David. Say it. Set me up. What's the pirate's favorite letter?
No, you do it. You
do.
No, 'tis the sea they love.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So it really was a setup.
It was a setup, yeah. And I've been my wife was telling me, do not tell that joke. But it works every time. Okay. So Marcus, we unfortunately at the recent American Historical Association meeting in Philadelphia, we were scheduled at the same time, so I couldn't attend your paper. But I know you spoke about graphic novels in history, and I'm curious as to what you brought to the AHA. What did you want to tell the AHA audience about graphic novels and graphic history?
Well, there are a lot of people who are curious about how do you do it? Mm-hmm. How do you turn serious history into a graphic novel? So I had one very clear piece of advice for them. Find a great artist like David Lester, and then it gets really easy from there.
It's true. I worked with Liz Clark, and it's really the artists who do the work.
It's true. And but basically what I talked about was the process that David and I went through in writing these two books, how we've gone back and forth, and what that looked like, how graphic novels happened in our case. Yeah, but I was kind of fascinated. Apparently the AHA, the American Historical Association, has a very serious project underway on graphic novels, taking them much more seriously than that conservative institution has done in the past. And there were people on our panel who were not graphic novelists, but who study it. Mm-hmm. So there's serious work going on, not only in creating the novels, but in scholarship about the cultural form.
Yeah, I know that Trevor Goetz, author of Abena right. and the Important Man, out with Oxford over a decade ago,
right.
Really another pioneer.
He was.
I think he's been doing a lot of work behind the scenes making this happen. He organized that special issue of the American Historical Review a few years ago, devoted to graphic histories and taking them seriously. It's nice to see. That institution opening up and becoming a bit more open. David, so how did you come into this project? This is the second time you've worked with Marcus, but how did you come into this project and go about adapting this into a graphic history? I mean, what's your perspective on the process, I guess, is the question.
Well, I mean, how did I get involved? Again, we've touched on it a bit, but it was through doing 1919 graphic history of the Winnipeg General Strike, and I did that under extraordinarily difficult situation of creating a 93-page book in 53 days. And after that, I thought I'd take a break. But then this guy Paul Buell emailed me about this other project about some guy named Benjamin Lay, and so that started this process of working with Paul and Marcus, because it went so well in terms of creating the book Profit Against Slavery, that we decided to work together again. And it's really like not unlike having a rock band, and you really need the gel there to that it work, that you collaborate together very well. And I think the three of us do. And so you don't always get that. Some say a rock band may have great musicians, but it doesn't mean it's going to work well. And it really has to do with how people treat each other, how people want to see a project develop and move along at a smooth rate. And I think we have that. So we're a good rock band, basically, that makes graphic novels. And so I took Marcus's, outline or treatment. And as he said, I broke it down into scenes because, as a maker of graphic novels, as the artist, you really want each scene to be very specific. So I put in, you know, essentially stage directions for myself to help flesh out the drawing process. But you know, the drawing is so intensive that you need all of these other things in place. And so obviously I consulted Marcus's book, Villains of All Nations, in great detail to add as much into the story and the art as I could. But I also had to do independent research in terms of how did people look in the 18th mm-hmm. century? How did they, what kind of coats did they have? What kind of shoes, what kind of hats, what kind of pipes did they smoke? What kind of songs did they sing? How did they dance? And you have to do this from the ruling, from the working class to the ruling class. Mm-hmm. So it's quite intensive. And remember, there are no photographs, there are no movies, no films of that time. You have to rely on whatever exists in terms of painting, which often was done for the ruling classes, and sketches and drawings that you can come across. And you have to use a certain amount of creativity as well in imagining a time. And so that goes into the process of making the book. And also I would add that when I finished the script, I did act it out with my partner, Wendy. And that was very instructive to play all these different parts and see how they sounded when you spoke them. Mm. And so that affected it as well. And we went back and forth with many drafts of the script over a period of perhaps 3 months until we were finally, you know, fine with how it went. And even in the process of creating a graphic novel, things change, they shift, because you may think you wrote it in a certain way and it's going to work. But when you come to visualize it on the page, it may not work, and you have to modify at that point, maybe modify the text or modify what the intention was there. So it does shift at times, despite being, you know, nailed down in terms of a script. So that was the basic process of how we work together.
And I love these scenes, and especially like the battle scenes are very exciting with these big swashes of ink across the stage. And I think maybe I said this last time, but it reminds me of so Ralph Steadman, the Hunter S. Yeah. Thompson's illustrator, with that the spilling of the ink and I mean it creates these pages that are just. Just really exciting and gripping. And there's these other pages where you start to present some of the detail. Like there's a little aside for social history where you're showing, I think it's they meet another pirate ship. And so they start engaging in trade, and it shows some of the tools that they want to get and the medical devices. And I spent a good 20 minutes like staring at those medical devices and trying to just,
well, I wanted to know what would they be trading? What would you need in the early 18th century if you were on a pirate ship? So what, because I didn't know, and I don't think most people would know what you mm-hmm. would need to keep the ship going, to fix the masts and fix the sails and what medical things you might need and what kind of food you would need. So yeah. I did spend a lot of time in great detail drawing that. So the reader would get a sense, a visceral sense of what are we talking about, you know? So you take away from all the action, but you go to the mundane nature. How do we operate this ship, and what do we need? And how does trade work? And so that was part of it. And I find that, you know, like I want to tell the listeners that the book is done in glorious black and white.
Yeah.
And I think of it as film noir meets the 18th century, because mm-hmm. I use a lot of shadows, a lot of dark. And I feel that black and white works really well in conveying to the reader of taking them back in time to the 18th century rather than the use of heavy color and gloss, which I think would distance a reader from the content. And I feel like in the work I've done in graphic novels, a lot of it has been to tell gritty social justice mm-hmm. history. Mm-hmm. And for that, I find that I need to have a gritty style of drawing. And I feel that matches the content, or at least tries to meet that content, that gritty action of rebellion, of the messiness of it all. And so I like to have paint splattered all over the place at times. So that's a lot of fun to do as an artist, but also I think it does give a sense of motion to the book, and that's part of it too. And I've used some filmic techniques, as people would cut up celluloid when they used to use celluloid to make films. Well, I cut up drawings occasionally to try to space them out on the page as a way to slow the reader down. So they have to look at the drawing, not once, but three different parts of the drawing to put the drawing together. And so I feel like that's, you know, you use every method you can to, but I feel that's a kind of a filmic method. And so that was, and actually you mentioned the excitement of the action scenes, but one of the most difficult things is to do the non-action scenes where people are deciding to vote on whether they want a democracy on the ship, and they're voting for who will be captain and who will
that, that came off as super exciting.
Did it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that scene in particular, that you did a really great job. You're voting on the captain, and then the trial. You have with the thumbs up and thumbs down, and I thought that it was very cinematic.
Well, good, because I felt like that's always in political art. That's often the most difficult thing to do is to depict ideas or the details of discussions, which often is the lot of a lot of politics. So the rebellion and action and fighting is one part of it, but there's also the intellectual side of it that has to go hand in hand with it. And that's where I often feel people, you know, don't succeed at. And I certainly was influenced by, you know, watching films by Ken Loach. And I think he does that very well in making, the discussions among people and making, trying to, you know, make their lives better, that he does a very good job at making that exciting as well. So that's good. Thanks. Yeah.
Great. And
I would just add, Mike, to what David said, that we were really striving, because this is history from below, we were really striving for social realism. And that social realism lies in all of the details, what the ship looked like, what those trade items looked like. But it also resides in the language. So we did use some 18th century speech, not so much as to make the book difficult to read for modern readers, but to just give it that social flavor that you really are dealing with a different world. And we wanted to evoke that in as many different ways as we could.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it comes with a glossary in the beginning for all the TARs, so we can understand what they're saying, right? Another thing I really appreciated was having spent a lot of time on boats was the bugs and the cockroaches and the lice and the and that just reminds me of like having spent a week or two on a boat in the tropics and just that, yes, that grittiness of life below decks. And we grew up on boats and my dad would always if there was a square rigger or something, we'd always have to go do a tour of that and see below, and he'd always say, just imagine, you know, you think about our boat and how clean we try to keep it, but like think about the 18th century and Egypt. What an impossible task it would have been just to have a level of hygiene that we could even comprehend. So anyway, the little bugs and all that, I found that really delightful.
Well, I wanted to give, again, the reader a visceral sense of life on the ship by having you know, the weevils and the cockroaches crawl up the page and have the rats very much visible and so give them an idea of just exactly what you're talking about, because it isn't all pristine, and it would have been, you know, the weevils are in your food and this is a part of what they were rebelling against and fighting for, the decrepit nature of life on a regular merchant ship. And how they were treated in terms of basic items like food. So it was important to show the weevils and to show the cockroaches and so that was intentional. Yes.
Yeah, this is real social history, right? when I teach the history of cotton, and using Sven Beckert's really fantastic book, Empire of Cotton, one of the things we talk about is, you know, what is wearing a garment like before cotton is common? And, you know, it's these wool garments that they wore in Northwestern Europe weren't, you know, beautiful things from Benetton or Banana Republic. You know, the itchiness and what, these aspects of daily life that are much more tactile and I think really important to understand for getting into other eras. But Marcus, can we circle back a little bit to the history of piracy, and what are some of the things people get wrong about pirates? Some of the things we think we know, but maybe we don't know, or we misunderstand. In other words, how is your work, both under the banner of King Death and Villains of All Nations, been a corrective to sort of conventional wisdom about piracy?
Well, I think the biggest thing that people need to know is that pirates were real people, as opposed to cartoonish stereotypes. And you see that in Pirates of the Caribbean. They're people with bad hair and bad teeth. And, you know, they're just all these stock stereotypes of working class people. Well, I started my research all those many years ago by asking some really simple questions about these pirates. Who were they? Answer to that question, they were ordinary, common, exploited sailors who were sick of their daily working lives on board these ships and the Navy and the merchant shipping industry. But then I wanted to say, how did they understand piracy? What did it mean to them? And then, relatedly, finally, why did they do it? And once you start asking those kind of questions, rather than simply assume that they're a bunch of violent thugs who are just all about greed, then you end up with some very different historical questions about how they organized their ships. Well, they did it in very democratic ways. We've talked earlier about the election of captains and officers. How did they divide up their loot? They did it in very egalitarian ways. The distance between the poorest sailor on a pirate ship and the captain was very narrow, unlike on all those other ships. So the sheer organization of the pirate ship demonstrated to me how the vision of these common sailors was about a better world, a better social world, a fairer, more just world. So if we can convey that through this graphic novel, I'd be very happy. But Mike, let me just help you with one question. In a previous conversation David and I had, he talked about the punk rock aesthetic of our book, and I'd like to hear him say more about that.
Yeah, I like to think of the art that I create as the ringing of a distorted punk rock chord. And so when I play, I use a lot of distortion on my guitar. And my favorite part is to let the chord ring, and it splinters out into the room or into wherever you're playing, into the club or whatever. And I think of that very much taking a punk rock approach to making a graphic novel, where the ink splatters from one page to the next and to the next, and we have full bleeds on these pages, which is great to have that option. And so there is a sense of continuity over the course of a 136 page book, that the ink rolls from one page to the other. And I think of it very much in the way sound waves travel, and so that's always in the back of my mind, as to how the whole thing flows together as a book. And I really almost think of it as a book, as a giant mural, if you could have it to be, you know, that large. Because to me, they're all, every page is connected. And that's the way I draw, the way I design the pages. And so that's part of the process that is always there. It's the sensibilities that I took to in my band Mechanormal with Gene Smith, the same aesthetic decisions one makes in making an art form, like music and lyrics, is the same one I take with graphic design, and the same with making a graphic novel and illustrations. So I feel that they're all connected. There's a thread there. If you live your life as an artist or a musician, rather than these are individual silos that are divorced from each other. For me, in my case, in other people's case, it may be that way, but for my case, they are all related, and the same sensibilities remain.
Well, I mean, with this book, I really feel that musical sense, but even more so in Benjamin Lay, which, you know, is ironically a book about a Quaker, and one thinks of, you know, sitting in quiet, but the color and the composition is, remember, like it's almost like some of the pages are screaming like for justice and raging against social injustices. So I'm going to go back and reread that this afternoon with that idea of looking for the sound waves. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Benjamin Lay, I mean, he was actually screaming, which went against, I think, a lot of Quaker principles at the time by speaking out in the way that he did. And yeah, I really wanted to have his voice be that kind of that hugeness, in a sense. And so that was very important. There was a lot of dynamic played there with, in terms of visuals, in terms of the height of how visuals were, which related to his height and the social dynamic of the time that he was doing his activism and his radical approach against slavery. And so again, the presentation of the work as an artist, I feel, has to be related to the content. There has to be a connection, and for me, that's important. Maybe for other artists, not so much, but that's always something that is in the back of my mind again.
Yeah, it makes me think of is it Katie Edwards' book Red Rosa, where she really ties image into Rosa Luxemburg's life, and I could give some examples of graphic histories that don't do that as well. There's one on Hannah Arendt that just caricatures of German philosophers with lots of speech bubbles. And it's like, no, like so many missed opportunities. I think both of these books, you did, you know, fantastic job in that regard. Just a little more on pirates, Marcus. What is your research in this book can tell us about gender and piracy? I mean, you have this character, Mark and Mary, that what's the gendered history of piracy that we should know?
Well, it's a well-known fact that the 18th century sailing ship was a hyper masculine work environment. Not only because it was almost always men who worked there, but because physical prowess was a significant part of the work. So it would be easy to think that in that environment, there was no place for women. And that proves not to be true. And not only not true in the case of piracy, I mean, not true in the case of deep sea sailing in general, because one of the discoveries of the last 20 years or so is that there were lots of women who dressed as men and went to sea, who joined armies, who joined navies. And moreover, they were common enough that there are a lot of popular ballads about them sung by working class people around the Atlantic. Now, in the case of piracy, we have two women pirates, one of whom is in our book, Mary Read. The other is Anne Bonny. And not only were they, powerful, swashbuckling types in every sense, they were famous in their own day. They were very well known around the world. And so what their stories tell me is that women too could find liberty under the Jolly Roger. It wasn't nearly as common, but it's certainly something that was true. And if you understand the histories of these two women, you can see how tough they were. Mary Read had served in the armies of continental Europe. She knew about weapons. She was physically very tough. There's a story about her, which we were not able to include in the graphic novel, but she had a lover on board the pirate ship who got into a scrap with a much tougher pirate, or so Mary Read thought. That rougher, tougher pirate challenged her lover to a duel. They were going to go on shore. They never fought on board the ship. And Mary was sure that this other pirate was going to kill her lover. So what did she do? She picked a scrap with that same rough, tough pirate, challenged him to a duel 1 hour before the duel involving her lover, went ashore, promptly killed the man on the spot, and saved the life of her lover. So this is Mary Read. I mean, we are talking about a very tough, savvy person who commanded a lot of respect in this wooden world of the ship.
Yeah, and I mean, in a related sense, I'm wondering about what your research can tell us about race and piracy. And slavery features prominently in Under the Banner of King Death.
One of the most important findings, Mike, of Villains of All Nations is that a very large percentage of the members of pirate crews were people of African descent. And I'm not talking about a handful. I'm talking about 20, 30, 40, 50%. So there are a very large number of people on board these ships. And one of the big questions is, where do they come from? Well, a lot of them are escapees from the plantation system. And people have asked me, why would European pirates want to take these African or African-American people on board? There were some pretty good reasons, not all of them ideological. I mean, they were accustomed, these sailors, to working as part of the motley crew, right? So the multiracial workforce was something they were all very accustomed to. But they wanted people to join the pirate ship who would be loyal to their enterprise. And I can promise you, a person who had escaped slavery on a plantation could be a very loyal member of the crew. And on top of that, it turns out, this is another major discovery in the past 20 years or so, a lot of the Africans who were enslaved and forced on slaving vessels and carried across the Atlantic had military training back in West Africa. This is actually one of the keys to why Toussaint Louverture and his army in Haiti were able to win their independence from France. There were a lot of trained soldiers among the enslaved. So race is kind of a fascinating thing in this situation. I think that's very important. I mean, the main character in our book is an escapee from slavery in South Carolina. That was a very big part of the world that we are writing about.
Mm-hmm. And then you've touched on this previously, but what does piracy tell us about the Enlightenment and Enlightenment thinking in the Atlantic world?
Well, what it tells us is that the Enlightenment was not simply a process of middle and upper class gentlemen in the salons of Europe, sipping their brandy and having their enlightened thoughts. That Enlightenment happened from below, and that it happened among pirates. They found ways to live together. To work together, to build something new together. You could say that the pirate ship was utopian for the common sailor, but I resist that description because utopia means no place. This was a very real place. And now along comes David Graeber, now passed away, I'm sorry to say, but his book, Pirate Enlightenment, adds a whole new wrinkle to this issue because he describes in that book the formation of a new ethnic group in Madagascar called the Betsy Misaraka, who basically are quite egalitarian, quite democratic in the way that they operate. And he argues, and I think shows very convincingly, that that culture is based on the principles of pirate ships, because lots of principles settled in precisely that part of Madagascar. They took Malagasy wives. So his idea is that this is a pirate enlightenment, but my attitude is it was only one of many.
Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating. And then just as an aside, I think we need a better understanding of the connection to the Indian Ocean world. Even those of us who've got some knowledge of piracy, got some knowledge of the Atlantic world, regularly, you know, don't make that connection just a little further, and how important that is. I mean, as a world historian and someone who works in Southeast Asia, I'm always trying to alert my students to the significance of the Indian Ocean world. And I was wondering, Marcus, if you could say a few words about maritime history. I wish that when I was in graduate school, I had known this was a field or gonna be a field. And it seems that there's so much exciting work going on in maritime history right now. And I've tried to work it into my master's seminars. I have students read a variety of things, including everything from Maya Jasanoff's book on Joseph Conrad to Eric mm-hmm. Tagliacozzo's work mm-hmm. on maritime Asia. He's got a fantastic book on maritime Asia that just came out. And I have my students read two of the Amitav Ghosh novels from the Ibis trilogy, where much mm-hmm. of it is set at sea, and you get this incredible portrait of the Lascars. And I noticed that you have in under the banner of King Death, you have someone signed Lascar Joe, and I was like, mm-hmm. the Lascars, and that there's these cultures in these histories at sea that mm-hmm. that aren't tied necessarily to one port or another, but really can only be understood at sea. Mm-hmm. So could you say a few words on the state of maritime history?
Well, look, in the very long dominant tradition of national historical writing, national and nationalist, okay, seafaring people are almost always marginal. They're outside the landed nation, right? I've said that history has what I call a terracentric bias. I sort of made this word up to describe the fact that almost everybody assumes that history is made on land in nation states. But of course it isn't. A lot of history happens at sea. Big historical processes happen at sea. Class formation happens at sea. Race formation happens at sea. Culture formation. I mean, you can't really even think the history of capitalism without taking the sea on board. It's that crucial. So in my view, the rise of transnational history, the rise of Atlantic history, Indian Ocean history, oceanic history, world history, has given a new, very great significance to seafaring people, because it was the labor of those people who connected the continents of the world. So they're no longer simply marginal, they're actually central to a lot of the history as we understand it. And I might just add that Amitav Ghosh is a friend of mine, and we have had many conversations about the motley crew. And this is, of course, what he writes about in that Indian Ocean context. And this is a fairly universal thing about the labor forces of the oceans of the world, and also in every port city. So this is a fascinating historical subject, and a historical subject that actually makes a lot of history.
Yeah, and again, so many exciting new works coming out. Both of you have been really generous with your time, but I've got two more questions for you before I let you go. These are the traditional New Books debriefing questions. Marcus, I'll start with you. What are you working on now, and what can we hope to see from you next?
Well, I'm working on a new graphic novel with David Lester. And I'm very happy about this. This will be our third. I'll say a little bit about it, and maybe David can say more, because as I understand it, we did finish the script a good while ago, and he's about, did you say, David, three quarters of the way through drawing it?
Yes.
So anyway, this is a graphic novel about the Afro-Irish conspiracy that took place in New York City in 1741. A remarkable story. It was what we're doing is based on a chapter in that book you mentioned, Mike, The Many-Headed Hydra, which I wrote with Peter Linebaugh. And so it's a third history from below. And I think it's a pretty exciting opportunity because what you see in that uprising is people of African descent, people of Irish descent, mulatto Cuban sailors, the motley crew of the waterfront coming together to plan an insurrection, an uprising from within the city. And so this is, and we've given a lot of emphasis in this book to how they did it, how they overcame their differences, what were the sources of solidarity among them, that sort of thing. So David would be better placed than I to say more about that. The other thing that I'm doing right now is writing a book about people who escaped slavery by sea in the 19th century. This is a book tentatively entitled Freedom Ship as a counterpoint to the other book, Slave Ship. And the idea is that, well, our visions of the Underground Railroad, and that's a metaphor, that's not a fact. It was neither underground nor was it a railroad. Our images of that are that it that escaping slavery was entirely by land. But I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to prove that if we look at those people who successfully got away, the ones who left slavery once and for all, a majority of them did it by sea. And so the ships that sail into southern harbors, Savannah, Charleston, Norfolk, Baltimore, these are almost all northern ships with motley crews, including quite a few black sailors who were very sympathetic to those people who wanted to escape slavery. So that's the book that I'm writing right now.
Well, I look forward to that. David?
Well, as Marcus said, I'm working on our next graphic novel. And my process of making a graphic novel, again, is to, I first draw everything in pencil. And so I'm 3/4 of the way through drawing those pencils, sketches, and then I will ink the pencils and then erase the unwanted pencil lines. And then I will paint on the drawings with watercolor to give it that dynamic and sense of depth that watercolor can give it. And so there's still a lot to do, but I feel very happy to be at the stage that I am. And of course, the book is divided into 3 sections, a large section about the planning and plotting of the uprising. And so a lot of meetings, a lot of dark cellars and taverns and dark nights in the street, on the waterfront, in the holds of ships. So it's been kind of interesting in that way. Very, it's very evocative is the sense of it. And then we go into the next section, which is the actual uprising. And then the final section is the imprisonment, arrest and trial that takes place. So it's a very structured piece, but it really is a structured piece about how rebellion takes place. And so anyway, that's exciting. I'm very excited about that. And I also recently got a large amount of a grant from the Canada Council in Canada, which is run by the federal government. So I've got this government grant to do a graphic novel on the life of Emma Goldman, the last year in her life, which she lived and died in Toronto. And so she would probably find that ironic to get government money to depict her revolutionary life. And
only in Canada.
Yeah.
Well, David, look at it this way. It's one of the best things they could do with their money.
Well, I think so. So I think they get a good deal. But I'm very happy to get that kind of financing, and it's very difficult to get it. So though that's going to be occupying my time, and as well, who knows whether the rock band of Marcus, Paul, and I will be doing another book, perhaps. We'll see. And And that would be great too. So, you know, that would be our fourth album, really, if we want to think of it. So the other thing that's happening is I'm very pleased to report that our previous two books are being published in different languages, in Korean and Italian editions of Prophet Against Slavery and Under the Banner of King Death, as well as next month there's a Verso is bringing out a British edition of British edition of Prophet Against Slavery, Benjamin Lay.
Oh, fantastic.
About that. As well,
and
as
there will be Clay, there'll also, you know, also be Italian editions.
Yes, Italian editions too. Also your play, Marcus. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, the Benjamin Lay juggernaut goes on. I am determined to do everything I can to make Benjamin Lay a part of our contemporary political life. So having written a scholarly book, having written with David the graphic novel, I've actually worked with people to compose a song or two. And now with my friend, the very distinguished playwright Naomi Wallace, we have a play called The Return of Benjamin Lay, which will have its world premiere in London in June. So that's taken up quite a bit of my time these days. So onward and upward with Benjamin Lay.
Fantastic. David, last question. Can you suggest two books for the audience?
Yes, I can. There's been an important graphic history of that details the forced evictions and imprisonment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War. And it's called We Hereby Refuse, Japanese American Resistance to Wartime Incarceration by Frank Abbey and Tamiko Nomura. And so it focuses on the West Coast of America, but in Canada, we did the same thing during the Second World War. We confiscated boats and houses and forced Japanese Canadians into essentially prisons for the course of the war. And not far from where I live is a grounds where there are barns which usually housed cows and pigs and stuff like that, and that's where the Japanese Canadians were originally housed. So it's really all, of course, a despicable on both sides of the border. And we do have a plaque there finally after about 50 years. They put a plaque there to acknowledge this injustice. And so anyway, it's a very good book. We Hereby Refuse, it's called. And the other one is Save It for Later, Promises, Protest, and Parenthood by Nate Powell. And it details it's kind of a memoir of the artist and his family during this dark time in American history after Trump was elected. And so it's a very defiant book, but it's also a hopeful one. And of course, it's beautifully drawn. So those are my two picks.
Great, great. And Marcus, two books.
Well, I must tell you that the great historian E.P. Thompson has been on my mind, because just yesterday, a colleague in the UK sent me a video of an interview that she did with Edward. This is the historian Penelope Corfield with Edward just a few months before he died in 1993. And it's a very powerful interview, although he's clearly in failing health. So I would recommend to people that they read not one, but two classic works of history from below. The first is Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class, published in 1963. And he actually tells a funny story about that book in this video. He says that he was working in adult education in Yorkshire, and some publisher offered him £50 to write a history of the British working class from 1800 to 1945. And Edward said, well, The Making of the English Working Class, which, by the way, is 832 pages long, is the first chapter in that history.
That's great.
And the other book is another classic by C.L.R. James called Black Jacobins, which is, I think, one of the very best books ever written about revolution, about Toussaint Louverture and the uprising in Haiti, then called Saint-Domingue, began in 1791, finally completed in 1804. Not only were the French imperialists evicted, Toussaint and his army of formerly enslaved people fought off Great Britain and Spain to become the second new nation in the Western Hemisphere, the first having been the United States. So I'm happy to recommend Thompson and James, because those two historians were really instrumental in the way that I see the past. I learned so much from them, and I do think your listeners would enjoy reading these two works.
And your collaborator, Paul Buell, is a biographer of C.L.R. James.
Yes, he is. He was actually, Paul deserves credit for having done a great deal to introduce C.L.R. James to American readers. People forget how little known James was outside of left-wing political circles. But Paul wrote the authorized biography with the cooperation of James and his friends and family.
Right. Well, David Lester, Marcus Rediker, thank you so much for your time and for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
Great. A lot of fun. Thank you.
So this has been a conversation with David Lester and Marcus Rediker about Under the Banner of King Death, Pirates of the Atlantic, a graphic novel, out with Beacon Press in 2023. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.